Carl, thank you so much. And we'll go ahead and move now into our Q&A session, including any questions for Charles, but also including any from the earlier sessions as well. I know we cut Paul's session a little bit short in terms of questions. I think there may have been some remaining from the states, and then of course also several questions after we just heard from Mike. So I'm gonna go ahead and get started calling on those folks that I see with their hands raised now. I don't actually know who call-in user 7 is. It might be Louise, is that right, Louise? You're still muted on the actual.
Yeah, how about now?
Perfect.
Okay, thank you so much, Stacy. Yes, this combo of using the computer plus the phone is a little too much for a boomer. Anyway, thank you both Mike and Charles. You know, great presentations, great discussion of important points. I have a number of questions for, not just for the two of them, but for other people as well. So I'm gonna try to ask just a few now, or perhaps a couple now, and then, you know, allow others to circulate, to rotate with me, so we have everybody having a chance to ask their own questions. So Mike, for you, Mike Wayne, thank you for the presentation. Kai asked a number of questions that I think address some of my clarification issues that I was looking for. But in terms of that slide where you had the actual graph of the harvest control rule, just to clarify, when using the harvest control rule process, you're actually not using an ACL, meaning if an ACL is exceeded, or even a control rule, the fishery would remain with existing regulations until a new biomass estimate is available to indicate what the stock status is?
Mike, you'll have to take yourself
Mike?
Off mute.
Yeah, can you hear me? Sorry about that. Can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
We can now.
Yeah, so you might have heard me say that we presented this as an option. We understand that the ACL requirement is going to be a challenge for this approach. We're seeking more guidance from the agency about the flexibility and how this would be relatable, but I think you make a valid point, which is, you know, the overfishing limit is in place to ensure overfishing isn't occurring. And of course, we wouldn't want this harvest control rule approach to jeopardize this resource. And so there is some reconciliation that needs to occur between the harvest control rule approach and the ACL requirement. But at this stage, we were trying to present the idea to get the discussion going about how an approach like this could be used, noting that there are requirements under the Magnuson Act that will need to be hurdled, but we wanted to try to provide opportunity for solutions and discussion instead of just, you know, settling for what we have.
Okay, gotcha, Mike. Thank you so much. Stacy, I'm gonna stop here, pause here to see if other folks on the panel have additional questions so I don't hog all the time. Thank you.
Thank you. I see Michelle's hand raised and Yang, so we'll turn to the two of them.
Thanks, Stacy. Yeah, I guess, you know, one question for Mike, and again, thank you, Mike, and for all the work that, you know, you and ASA has done to try to explore this issue of different management approaches for recreational fisheries. And I think I might be asking the same question as Kai, but maybe a little bit more bluntly, but, you know, what trade-offs are anglers willing to handle or put up with for stability in management? So the graph of the harvest control rule approach looks, you know, like you have stable management measures that, you know, change only with a change in, you know, stock status, although, you know, summer flounder being an exception this past year where there was such a big step-like jump, you know, it seems like we're not usually in that type of situation where when we get an assessment back, we're having such dramatic increases or decreases. And so I guess, you know, in trying to think about this and, you know, reconcile this desire for stability with the fact that we will continue to receive assessments and SSCs will continue to set ABCs, I'm just wondering, you know, are anglers going to be willing to forego some harvests when there's an ACL that goes up as opposed to, you know, having some liberalization in the measures that they're under? Are they willing to forego that extra harvest for the sake of stability, knowing that, you know, a couple years down the road, the situation might be the opposite where, you know, an annual catch limit is actually decreased and they will, you know, be able to maintain their same measure? So what trade-offs are anglers willing to put up with in terms of potentially foregoing additional harvest for stability?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where the angler input comes into the harvest control, the development of the harvest control approach. And so the way we propose it here, Michelle, is that anglers are willing to make trade-offs to bring stability to the fishery and the management process. And I think you know, how well that's received will depend on how much engagement we're able to accomplish in developing an approach like this. And of course, we'll hear from the entire community about what they're willing to offer in terms of trade-off to bring stability to the fishery, like what we suggest in this approach. But I do think that, and perhaps there's more steps needed, for example, so that the harvest control rule approach is more responsive to changes in stock condition. So we propose, you know, several steps, but maybe additional steps would be needed to try to refine what exactly those trade-offs would look like on the spectrum of stock status and what anglers want out of the fishery.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to call on Yang, Kai, and then Louise again, if you have another question.
Thank you, Stacey. Thank you, everyone, for very informative presentations. I think I learned a lot. So my overall impression from all the talks, I think, is looks like in-season management, you know, has a limited success in Mid-Atlantic areas. And I was wondering, you know, if you have all the resources, what can we do to improve that? And I, especially, I think all the comments from Charles, I think, you know, all the histories. And so I, you know, of course, there's a lot of limitations in terms of financial limitation, capacity, and all the issues. And it, but if you have all the, you know, resources, how we can improve that? That's my first question. My second question is related to, I think, Mike's presentation. I think it's a very interesting approach. But I think I look at this, you know, stepwise approach. I think harvest control rule approach. It seems to me that all very much depend on the high quality stock assessment, and which of course really depend on the high quality data. And so the data quality still, you know, for recreational fisheries still very important. I think we can see from Paul's presentation in the morning. And it's not like you know, recreational data quality is less important, and you can use you know, stepwise harvest control rule to overcome that problem. You still really depend on the high quality data for the assessment. So I was wondering, you know, how what happened if you have you know, pretty noisy or very uncertain stock status, and how your approach can overcome that issue. Can I ask one more question in a row?
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, so my third question is for Paul. Paul, really nice to see you again here. I think you were talking about it. I think it's a really good list of all the, you know, sources of uncertainty. And but I noticed that, you know, there are basically there are two very different sources for uncertainty. One is bias uncertainty. You know, talking about retrospective patterns, talk about, you know, biased errors. Those are very different from random errors that are associated with the data that, you know, we collect from well-designed sampling programs. So I was wondering, you know, you talk about a CV, you know, CV, we usually define the random errors. So I was wondering, have you considered biased errors? That is a very different from random errors in assessment when you quantify, you know, the data quality in assessment. Thank you.
Thank you, Yong. So I didn't catch if there was anybody in particular that you were directing your first question about, in whether or not what you would do differently if you had all the resources in the world. But is there anybody that would like to take that question? And Yong, is there anybody that you were directing it to?
Not really. I just the overall impression. So I hope someone, you know, who probably some people work in the council, you know, kind of have an overall vision about this.
Yep. Would anybody like to take that question? I see Julia and Kylie are both on the line. I think Mike had to jump off.
Or maybe I also would be interested in to hear from Charles, you know, for his vision, because he's the one actually very explicitly stated that in-season management does not work. And it looks like you have no hope for it to be work.
Yeah, the problem with in-season management in the Mid-Atlantic is really twofold, or at least again in the section where I am in the upper Mid-Atlantic. The first is that it doesn't allow anglers or angler-related businesses to plan out their seasons. Charter boats will book trips for late in the season. Party boats will plan to fish late in the season. Anglers will take their vacation late in the season. And if you get an in-season closure, they may not have anything to fish for. It's better to set regulations with a long season, a smaller bag limit, and a higher minimum size, so that you still constrain catch adequately, but you don't lose season length. It's something that anglers and the angling industry pretty well agrees to in this region, that season is the single most important component of a set of regulations. And the other problem with in-season management, and to some extent we're seeing it even without in-season management here, is that a closure would lead to effort shift onto another species. Right now, to give an example that actually didn't come out of an in-season management situation, but it's occurring anyway, there are a lot of black sea bass out there right now. Now, roughly, I'm guessing they're about 200% of target biomass, somewhere in that range. Yet we already have very restrictive regulations on them, because the summer flounder fishery isn't very good right now. It's very difficult to catch a legal summer flounder because, again, because recruitment was off for a few years. But we have some very big fish from 2009 approximately, and then we have very few legal fish after that. So the summer flounder fishermen are all switching over to black sea bass. The party boats that used to fish for summer flounder in the bay and close to shore, yeah, they say they're doing summer flounder trips, but they're doing summer flounder trips around the wrecks. They're doing summer flounder trips on the artificial reefs where most of their catch is black sea bass because they need to get something for their customers to put in the pail. So when you close one season, mid-season, as you would with in-season management, you shut down the possibility of people fishing for one species. They cause problems with another species. There's always the other side, arguably, that you might say, hey, we can actually extend a season. That's not an impossibility, but the downside risk is much more. A few years ago, in New York, I think it was 2007, we had a new commissioner of our Department of Environmental Conservation. He shut down the summer flounder season early. I can only tell you what sort of outrage you heard throughout the angling community because people had nothing to fish. That was before the black sea bass came back. And people had nothing to fish for in September. And that's something that just it wouldn't be tolerated up here.
Thank you, Charles. Young, you had two other questions, one directed at Mike and the other directed at Paul. Mike, do you want to take that second one? You are on mute, Mike. Yes, there you go.
Yeah, Stacy, I was wondering, would it be okay if Adam chimed in?
Absolutely, yes. If Adam was wanting to respond to this, go right ahead, Adam. You may need to click star 6 to unmute yourself. Adam, we're not able to hear you. I think you are probably calling user 9. If you're able to unmute using star 6, you may also need to unmute your phone. Yep, so now you're unmuted on the WebEx. Go ahead. We still aren't able to hear you. I can see that you're not muted through WebEx. It's possible you're still muted on your phone, but if we're not able to hear from you, we'll go ahead and just I'll ask for your. Oh, go ahead. Now we can hear you.
All right, you can get something from me now.
Yes, we sure can. Thank you, Adam. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks for the technical help here as well. So let me applaud this group for doing a wonderful job of getting about as diverse opinions on alternative management as you could possibly get from what you've heard this afternoon. I think it's certainly a very healthy conversation and is outstanding to be able to hear those very diverse viewpoints. I'll try to touch on a number of the things that I've heard people ask questions about regarding the harvest control rule approach. And I think I can answer those questions wearing both my hat from a management perspective, as well as a fisherman as well. I can speak to the impacts of management on my business, on the anglers, on me, as well as the challenges that we've had to deal with. Let me begin by saying that in season, I know that a lot of the impetus for this discussion is what could we do with the use of MRIP data for in-season management? And I think the answer is a very clear no in its current format. It's a management approach that was considered a decade ago by the Mid-Atlantic Council. It was quickly discovered not to be viable. It was quickly rejected. There's been some consideration about thinking about it again, but the one common denominator from both of the people you've heard from right now to this afternoon is that neither of them support using MRIP for its in-season management. Now, what could we improve if we could do anything? I think the easiest thing we could improve very quickly is going ahead and using MRIP in the manner it was intended to be used. MRIP was never intended to be a to the fish, to the pound number to hold management accountable. It was originally created in order to be a long-term trend provider for fisheries. I think it does a adequate job, maybe even a good job of providing those long-term trends of recreational participation in catch, but it is fallen woefully short in its ability to provide year-to-year reaction to measures, and certainly not for in-season management measures. With regards to the concerns about exceeding OFL and ACL, I'll say that the concept of the harvest control rule approach, recreational reform, we have found in the Mid-Atlantic, the Greater Atlantic Regional Office, has been an excellent partner in working with us, both managers and fishermen, in working with myself, working with Mike, on the proposal for the harvest control rule in terms of providing feedback. And what we've talked about is developing a series of signposts that would go with each of these steps that would inform how we would react to them. So in the case, while at its simplest level, which is really what the graph that Mike's provided at this point intends to provide, is a very high-level overview of trying to tie measures to stock status, the intention is that each of those steps would have accompanying signposts related to indicators such as harvest, such as where we are relative to an OFL and harvest, such as have we exceeded an RHL in repeated years. There's a number of signposts we've discussed that we could attach to these steps to define how management would react to each of those. Furthermore, one of the things that, as Mike indicated, that he was going to pass on a longer version, I think it was about 4 pages, the last version I saw of it, about proposal to the harvest control rule. In terms of simplifying it, the top and bottom levels, the most restrictive measures when stock status was going to be not as healthy as it should be, we have described as not just being what the angling community would tolerate, not just as what would have negative economic impacts, but more importantly, a set of measures that have proven over time to no longer provide a tangible biological benefit to the recovery of a stock. We have seen both at the Mid-Atlantic and the ASMFC level that there's a certain set of measures we get to that stocks simply no longer respond to. There are other environmental factors. Charles touched on the summer flounder fishery redirecting to structure-oriented. Well, the reason for that is because other habitat, such as lumps, such as areas of natural bottom that these fish could find prey historically, have been destroyed from a dredging perspective, from beach replenishment. So all of those areas that these fish no longer were on, they aren't gone because of a depletion of the resource. They've gone because there's no longer food there because there's a destruction of the habitat. So in those cases where survey work was done in those areas, they're not going to find fish there anymore. So weak fish is another example that we have extremely restrictive measures in place at the ASMFC level. They're simply not coming back right now to the levels we'd like them to see as a result of other environmental factors. So So I think it's important to stress that with the harvest control rule, it's not just based on what the angling community can tolerate, but there is a biological factor that we've provided. And yes, to Michelle's question, the concept of what is the recreational sector willing to give up? At the top end of things, there is a set of recreational measures where, quite frankly, on a species-by-species level, the angling community reaches a level of access where there's no longer a benefit to them. The angling community, by and large, is not clamoring for a 14-inch summer flounder that provides so little yield to meat and an inability to fillet for most anglers. They're simply not interested in going back to a set of measures like that. So on the top end of things, there's absolutely a set of measures whereby the angling community is willing to provide yield to the benefit of the resource, knowing, okay, we're going to give this up here because we don't need those fish. We recognize the conservation benefit, and we look forward to when we move in the other direction that the stock is in need of more conservation, that will have provided a benefit to address that. So I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks to Mike for turning to me to provide some input. Hopefully I've provided some input to answer in more detail some of the questions that have been asked so far, and any other follow-up questions, I apologize. I'm only on the phone right now, so I can't raise my hand to respond, but if anyone has any other direct questions, now we got this tech stuff figured out, thanks to Stacy's help, please let me know. I'll happy to go into further detail.
Adam, thank you very much. I appreciate your response there. We are pretty much out of time, but I'm gonna just, you know, if folks are comfortable holding on a little bit longer, I'd love to get through the remaining questions. I know Yang had one more for Paul. If I can direct his last question at Paul to respond to, and then we're gonna call on Kai Lorenzen, and I'll wrap up by giving Louise the final word if he has any additional questions or just wants to help us sign off. I will end things with Louise. The one note I want to make before we get to Yang's final question is just if there are any additional questions that folks have or comments or feedback for the committee or documentation you think the committee should be considering, please send those my way. We have a great group of participants on the line today. I'm sure we'll be in touch with many of you after this meeting as well. And so I'm happy to follow up on additional questions, thoughts, comments, documentation, et cetera. Yang, your last question was directed at Paul, and Paul, I'll let you go ahead and respond to that unless you need a refresher on the question.
Oh, no, I think, I'm okay. I think, thank you, Yang, and I appreciate the comment. I think you identify a key issue. There is a difference between random variation based on, let's say, a design-based consideration that is generally small relative to the bias uncertainty associated with things like retrospective pattern. So retrospective pattern is generally an indicator of absence of or lack of model fit. And also that you've misspecified the model in some way. Those arise obviously through a variety of mechanisms, one of which we've seen in spades, which is the bias induced by even the best design surveys such as MRIP may in fact have a systematically biased estimator of total removals. More importantly and more of consequence to the assessments is when these have a time trend associated with them so that the bias propagates and that the models try to compensate by fitting in various ways, but in fact the tension in the model when it's released through reductions in single years and so forth can cause some problems. Bias uncertainty also arises, say, in observer data that's used to estimate discards. There's definitely a sense that there's a Heisenberg effect associated with those estimates. So those can certainly factor into all of these things. And to your point, we don't necessarily distinguish them. We don't bifurcate the uncertainty into those pools. We recognize that there is uncertainty associated with the precision of the surveys, but like you comment, misspecification of natural mortality, changes in natural mortality over time, things of that nature also induce the uncertainty. So we end up dealing with the aggregate effects of those. And I wish we had a one-to-one mapping of those sources of uncertainty to a continuous form of that. But I think there's an explicit recognition that we're probably kidding ourselves to try to get such a one-to-one mapping that we could quantify sufficiently. So I hope that answers your question. And
Thank you, Paul.
Yes, thank you very much, Paul. Kai, I will turn it to you for your question.
Thank you, and I also wanted to take the opportunity to thank everyone. It's been a really, really interesting session, and I wish we could go on for longer. It's a question to Charles Witek, really, about the contrast you drew between the federal and the Atlantic states system and the alternative management approaches versus ACLs. And it seems to me there's sort of two distinctly different things at play. One is the mandate of the Magnuson-Stevens Act to avoid overfishing, but that really gives it a teeth that we don't see in the state or multi-state management systems. And the other is actual approaches to data collection and assessment and harvest control rules, you name it. And it seems to me that mostly we're concerned with data in this panel, but it seems to me that perhaps the biggest distinction here is the mandate to really avoid overfishing or not having that mandate. And that in fact, if you do have that mandate, there are probably multiple alternative ways of implementing that would give you quite similar results. I just wanted to see if you had some comment on, the relative role of that central mandate and the data collection and management approaches on the other hand in getting to the outcomes that you described.
I think you really hit the heart of the matter. Is if you think of ASMFC management right now, think of the regional fishery management councils prior to the Sustainable Fisheries Act in 1996. They didn't do very well either. The hallmark, really, the watershed of American fisheries management that brought it into the modern era was when the court decided Natural Resources Defense Council versus Dale, that said you have an obligation to rebuild these stocks. You have to have at least a 50% probability of achieving your goals, and you had the Magnuson mandate. I never want my comments about ASMFC to reflect ASMFC staff. They're wonderful people. You have great scientists there. You have great people working, and they use good data. A striped bass stock assessment came out and saw 66. It was the same stock assessment workshop done by the Northeast Fishery Science Center as did the summer flounder assessment. So the data is fine. The problem is if you have a hard decision to make, you're probably going to duck it if the law doesn't require you to do it. You're going to turn around and you're going to say, oh God, these people are here and it's really hard because he says he's going to go out of business and she says her husband's going to commit suicide if this law goes into effect. And how can we do this? Well, the way you do it, and quite honestly, something that I think we need very badly, is a change to the Atlantic Coastal Fisheries Cooperative Management Act that adopts the basic Magnuson-Stevens standards and applies them to ASMFC. That is the only way you're going to bring ASMFC into the modern era. Otherwise, you're going to continue to see people saying, oh, well, yeah, I know weak fish are in serious trouble, and I know that the biologists recommended a moratorium, but people need a fish to bring home. You're going to see winter flounder, southern stock winter flounder collapse. There were something like 8 million landed in New York in the mid-1980s. By recreational anglers, it's about 500 now. Yet you see ASMFC expanding the season from a 60-day season to a season that runs from March 1st to December 31st, because, hey, why not? You know, the commercial guys can catch them. This is what you need to get over. ASMFC will never be an effective management body if it can allow overfishing to continue and if it can avoid rebuilding overfish stocks, if they don't have the time limits. I'm a very strong supporter of Magnuson-Stevens. I'm a very strong opponent of the people trying to weaken the law, because I think it's the only way you are going to have effective fisheries management are the Magnuson-Stevens mandates.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charles, and Kai as well. All right, I really appreciate everybody that stuck with us. I know we've run quite a ways over time, but the discussion's just been so great. It's hard to cut it off. And certainly I know there are others that would love to chime in. And what I would ask of everybody on the line is, please don't feel like when we close this meeting today, that's the end all be all and you won't have the opportunity for input. You always do. Please don't ever hesitate to shoot me an email with any comments or questions. I'm very happy to receive any documentation that you might want the committee to consider. So if you didn't have an opportunity today to weigh in or to ask your question, again, please know that you can always be in touch with me. I want to just take a moment before I turn this over to Louise for any final question or final words. I want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers today, to thank those folks that have had the opportunity to weigh in and ask questions and provide responses. This is such a critical aspect of our, you know, consensus report process, is this information gathering effort. And it doesn't happen without the, you know, voluntary efforts of all of our committee members, as well as all of our meeting participants. And we recognize that, and we're grateful for that. So just sort of final words from me, a very heartfelt thank you to everybody, and a looking forward to staying in touch as we move forward throughout this process. With that, I will turn it over to Louise for a final question, if he has one, or any closing remarks for the day. Oh, we got to get you off mute. Now you can? Yep.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Sorry about the confusion there. No, I don't really have any other questions. Actually, I have a million other questions. This has been such a great day, and I really want to echo what you just said and express what other committee members, you know, the points they have already made, and thank all of you for this great day of great discussions. Your contributions have been incredibly helpful, very interesting, very informative presentations, and your patience with us in addressing all the different questions, right? A variety of different perspectives, and I cannot thank you enough, really, for this, and just want to let you know that, as Stacy pointed out, we're going to be continuing moving to other regions, stay informed and connected to our website to learn of our next meetings, when they will be. You're more than welcome to join us then as well and hear about discussions as the discussion continues into other regions. And again, thank you for this great day of discussion. Back to you, Stacy.
All right. Well, with that, again, I'll echo the thanks for patience. The questions come up whether or not we have dates set for our New England meeting. And we do not yet, but that is on our agenda for tomorrow. So we will post that on our website as soon as one is settled. And I will be sure to let those of you that have specifically asked me for that information, I'll be sure to let you know once we've got that settled as well. Thank you for sticking with us through a long day. I won't hold any of you any longer, but do be in touch if you have any questions or comments, and enjoy your afternoon. Thanks again.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.